Thanks very much for the invitation, Shelley. I'll just make sure that all the things that... Yep. I think that's... No, that's not right. Get this right first. Yeah. I'd like to begin by... I know yesterday you acknowledged the traditional custodians of the land, and I'd like to do that on my own behalf again here this morning. I'd also like to acknowledge yourselves. This talk is going to be about human rights and about human rights defenders, and I'd like to acknowledge yourselves and others as defenders of the rights of gay, lesbian, bisexual and transgender persons. I want to begin by making what I think is a very clear positional statement. And it is about the legal rights of persons. I'm going to read a bit of this because I want to make no mistake in terms of the international law dimension of what I want to talk about. GLBT rights are legal human rights. They're not aspirational claims, ethical wishes, or moral desires. We need to assert this because the promotion, protection, realisation and advancement of these fundamental rights, they are not optional exercises on the part of the state, but they are obligations incurred under international law. The international obligation is beyond question, and I think a major objective of further advocacy and human rights activism needs to be an affirmation of the obligation under international law, and an affirmation that there is no hesitation in international law to assert those rights. We know now that many states have laws and constitutions that guarantee the rights of equality and non-discrimination without distinction on the basis of sex, sexual orientation, or gender identity. All people, and it's important to stress all, regardless of sexual orientation or gender identity, should enjoy all the rights that are gathered together in the international rights regime. In this country, we do have a tendency not to talk a great deal about the international rights regime. Just moving away fractionally from what I was going to say, there is a tendency in this country, and particularly in the last few years, to dismiss criticisms of Australia, whether those criticisms are to do with Indigenous matters or refugee matters, whenever a report comes out from international bodies, those associated with international human rights conventions and the UN, when those reports come, there's a tendency for Australian government to dismiss them. We do that at our great peril because we are one small globe and we are living in a global community. We talk all the time about globalisation, about our interconnectedness, and one of the most critical foundations of all of that is our international law. So it is not an optional exercise or a passing fancy to look at international law, but we need to affirm that international law as applying to all human beings, irrespective of particular characteristics. I could say quite a lot about that in terms of how that international regime is constructed, but that's a very fundamental point. Cutting down a little bit further in that, I don't know how much you already know about this, and I assume an awful lot. But in the 2004 report from the UN Special Rapporteur on the right of everyone to the enjoyment of the highest attainable standard of physical and mental health, the rapporteur says this: Sexuality is a characteristic of all human beings. It is a fundamental aspect of an individual's identity. It helps to define who a person is. The special rapporteur in his report to the UN had no doubt that the correct understanding of fundamental human rights principles, as well as existing rights norms, leads inexorably to the recognition of sexual rights as human rights. Sexual rights include the right of all persons to express their sexual orientation with due regard for the well-being and rights of others, without fear of persecution, denial of liberty, or social interference. And that special rapporteur is only one of a growing body of international human rights mechanisms and reports from treaty bodies to affirm the central principles of the contemporary international rights regime, namely an individual's right to privacy, equality, integrity, autonomy, dignity, and well-being. So with that overarching framework, we can then go to other important human rights matters. The fundamental principle of the International Covenant on Civil and Political Rights, for example, says all persons are equal before the law and are entitled, without any discrimination, to the equal protection of the law. The law shall prohibit any discrimination and guarantee to all persons equal and effective protection against discrimination. And one of the characteristics is sex, and sex is defined as including sexual orientation. And you would be more than aware of the Human Rights Committee's findings in the Toonen versus Australia case some years ago, where under the Tasmanian Criminal Code, criminalising same-sex relations was regarded as an arbitrary interference in the right to privacy. And the Human Rights Committee affirmed that the reference to sex in the International Covenant on Civil and Political Rights must be taken to include sexual orientation. And we know that subsequent to that, those laws were repealed. We also know that subsequent to that, various treaty bodies, including the Convention on the Elimination of Social, the Convention dealing with social, cultural and economic rights, the Convention on the Elimination of Discrimination Against Women, all of those have continued to reaffirm that central principle. The final point that I'm not sure if you're aware of, I assume that many of you are, in March of this year, a group of international lawyers gathered in Yogyakarta in Indonesia, and they have devised the Yogyakarta principles on the application of international human rights law in relation to sexual orientation and gender identity. I'm not sure whether people are aware of these, but if you're not, I'll certainly give you the reference to this, because it's extremely interesting set of principles. They are regarded by many as quite groundbreaking principles on sexual orientation, gender identity, and international law. And they attempt to provide international law bodies and the UN and those bodies set up under treaty systems with a further set of principles to guide considerations of law in relation to this area. I guess you can just summarise that by saying there is a huge body of international law which is now not equivocating at all about the legal rights of persons as defined under many of the UN fundamental conventions. Well, I guess if you say, if that's the case, then why are there necessities to continue the evolution of human rights law? And there are two things that I want to do. First of all, despite that law being in place, as you well know, discrimination, persecution, of persons because of their sexual orientation or gender identity continues in a widespread scale around the world. Amnesty International's latest report says this: human rights violations targeted towards persons because of their actual or perceived sexual orientation or gender identity constitute a global and entrenched pattern of serious concern. The violations include extrajudicial killings, torture, ill treatment, sexual assault, invasion of privacy, arbitrary detention, denial of employment and education opportunities, discrimination in relation to the enjoyment of other forms of human rights. And these violations are often compounded by violence, hatred, discrimination and exclusion, similar to those based on race, age, religion, disability or economic and social status. Amnesty and others observe that despite being illegal under international human rights law, in many countries there is a legal prohibition on same-sex relations. That's often in conjunction with widespread abuse of minorities, and that impedes the enjoyment of sexual and reproductive rights by many persons, including lesbian, gay, bisexual and transgender persons. That also leads into a range of impunity actions by police, who in policing these laws both attack victims directly and also attack their families and friends and supporters. In its latest report, Amnesty identifies some 70 countries where there is now significant violence towards or discrimination against GLBT persons, and where statutes remain on the books which criminalise these actions. I've got a rather long list here which I'm not going to read out, but as we're gathered here together, as you know, only a week ago in Russia, in Moscow, the Gay Pride March there was disrupted by police under the instructions of the mayor of Moscow. Despite this march being supported by many in the European Parliament, and people were imprisoned, belted up, and the march disrupted, that fundamental right to freedom of expression, freedom of organisation, freedom of speech has been disrupted once again in Russia. In Poland, there are extraordinary statements being made about same-sex relationships, coming from the Ministry of Education, which recently has issued promulgations which prohibit any educational material relating to the promotion of homosexuality. And unfortunately, that word homosexuality appears in the same line as any other forms of deviancy. In Cameroon, the Roman Catholic Church there has issued several statements denouncing homosexuality and encouraging government authorities to crack down hard on anybody who promotes notions of equality. In Uganda, again, the Uganda Joint Christian Council has been involved in deploring activities by lesbian and homosexual people and condemning all of those actions based, obviously, on the teachings of the Bible. And in Nigeria and Nicaragua and so on and on it goes. I wanted to say a word about yourselves in particular, because one of the things that has been happening around the world for a number of years now is that those persons who are involved in the defence of human rights, and that defence can be trade unions, it can be journalists, it can be politicians, it can be people in Brazil who are trying to protect their lands, it can be a whole range of persons who are standing in solidarity with people who are having their human rights violated. These persons are broadly termed human rights defenders, and I would very broadly include all of you in that category. Human rights defenders are now being targeted by the state and by persons because of their defence of the human rights of others. and Amnesty, Human Rights Watch, and a whole range of other organisations have taken up the case of the human rights defenders, because often the human rights defenders are included in attacks, they're included in violence, they're included in discrimination, and there are many instances where police will turn their backs, the judiciary will turn their back, and the general flavour is, well, these people are getting what they deserve because they're standing up for the rights of others. And that inclusion of an importance to stand in solidarity with people who are defending others' human rights is something that I think the human rights movement globally, has been able to take into its arms and place a great emphasis on the protection of people who are defending their human rights. So I guess that's just by way of setting some sort of platform for this. I don't think there's any doubt that in human rights law internationally, the rights of gay persons, lesbian persons, transgender persons, there is no doubt, under definitions in international law, that these are not optional exercises. I'm making myself clear, they are legal rights. The challenge is the translation of those legal rights into, at the international level, into domestic law. I sometimes think that some of these things are just so obviously simple. When I drive home from here later, I don't have an option about which side of the road I drive on. We've got laws, we've got rules, they're embedded. Now, in my way of thinking, discrimination that is based on a particular human characteristic, the central tenet of the human rights law, the human rights movement, is there shall not, there ought not to be any discrimination against persons because of a particular human characteristic. We've seen that happen in relation to things like race. We've seen that happen in relation to things like disability. We've seen it happen in relation to things like language and ethnicity. It's simply a characteristic of a human being. There ought not to be, in law, any discrimination. And I mean any discrimination. And I guess I'd like to make just four observations. I'm probably way out of tune here on where I should be with this. Four quick observations on this... it's not moving. This thing. The first thing is that we've talked about 70 countries. I could go through different countries. We've talked about massive, not just discrimination, but violence against people because of this particular characteristics. But we theoretically live in a post-enlightenment age. We live in a secular society. And a secular society ought to be basing its laws not on religious values, but on agreed values that a secular society comes up with. So the first thing to say is that we live in a secular state, and we ought to have our laws based on secular values, and that those values need to be informed by, to some extent, what is in our international legal regime. The second thing is that I have, and I was talking to Shelley before I came here, about linking the slowness in terms of a full recognition of rights to, one, the propositions that are put forward by major religions and the rising influence of the religious fundamentalists, both the Christian fundamentalists and the Islamic fundamentalists. Well, people can have their religious beliefs, but those religious beliefs cannot be used as a basis for law in a secular society. The third observation is, and we've seen this just in the last couple of days, that somehow if same-sex relationships are legalised, social chaos is going to then prevail. I'm sure you've all heard it. That is a belief. It is not sociologically, scientifically, there is no evidence that that will happen. So you can't go around making laws on the basis of some sort of idealistic notion of what is family. And you certainly can't make it on threats of social chaos when you have absolutely no evidence for it. You may have a belief about it. I, when I was younger, had a belief about the Easter Bunny. But I'm not going around to make laws based on my belief about the Easter Bunny. I need to really show people that the Easter Bunny is there, and maybe we can go from wherever we go only after we've demonstrated the existence of the Easter Bunny. So I think the Easter Bunny is a good little parallel, because lots of people have believed in that and other sorts of fictions, but as the basis of law, it's very, very problematic. And the fourth observation, these are observations only, is that, of course, we will always have politicians who will use these issues not to bring people together, but because there is a short-term political advantage in it. The history of the human rights movement has been absolutely permeated with that sort of short-term advantage for long-term incredible pain for people. So they're just four observations about why would we have an international law regime which is unequivocal about the rights of persons, juxtaposed next to a reality where those rights are violated, and in many instances violated in profound ways. And one of the common threads that exists there is, I think, the religious influence on this debate. I think I've got a reasonable idea about the relationship between institutionalised religion and the state. And I've got some idea about the role of the state and the responsibility of the state to make laws for all persons in the state. Let me tell you, there are not that many other people of a Sunday morning currently talking and wondering about the role of the state, secular society, state and law, religion, and all of those things at just past 9:30 of a Sunday morning. But they are just absolutely crucial issues, aren't they? Because there is no doubt that our value system, both in our society and other societies, is very heavily influenced by our inheritance from particular religious traditions. But this role of the state is not to make laws based on those particular religious traditions. State is about diversity, difference, and reconciling those diversity and differences. Bringing particular religious values into the lawmaking process is not what a state ought to be about. Having said that, you and I both know that in the last couple of decades, we have seen a rise of religious fundamentalism, which is making the existence of the secular state more and more difficult. I don't want to exaggerate that statement, but you know that in the United States, for example, the influence of the religious right on the Bush administration has been profound. We know that politicians in Australia are becoming very wary of offending the religious right. And we know that around the world there are discussions about the rise of Islamic fundamentalism and the relationship between the state and Islamic fundamentalism. That's all part and parcel. And the rights of persons that you and I are interested in this forum are right plonk in the centre of that debate. So we need to address the influence that institutionalised religion is actually having on the lawmaking process if in the future we're to further advance the fundamental notions of equality of all before the law. I hope that makes sense to you. I think people are maybe a bit reluctant to go down this line, but it seems to me to be, you don't have to be a genius to see the links that are there together. Again, when I was thinking about this, because I have a I have a marked interest in religious fundamentalism because I see it as an extraordinary threat to human beings. They make no bones about it. I just said, I don't care what sort of religious fundamentalism. In fact, fundamentalism, almost of any brand, I see as a really marked threat to the liberty, dignity, value of individual human beings. Fundamentalists, it seems to me, don't really care terribly much about the dignity of those individuals who don't share their mind view. So fundamentalists of all persuasions, I think, are relatively frightening in terms of the consequences of where they may go with their behaviour and with their actions. And the rise of fundamentalism in the last couple of decades has been one of the characteristics of our society, one of the characteristics of our political life. But in fact, you don't really have to go to those who are fundamentalists to find enormous threats to the equality that should be enjoyed by everyone. Pope Benedict, very recently, and as you know, the Catholic Church, the Vatican, more precisely, holds special observer status in the United Nations, and it's used its political weight very, very frequently to oppose the extension of basic human rights to same-sex couples. And Pope Benedict himself has actively intervened in politics, to squash recognition for lesbian and gay families and to threaten people who support it. This is a report from Human Rights Watch, which, again, I'm happy to steer people in the right direction. In January this year, the Pope told Italian politicians, any plans to recognise unions other than traditional marriage would appear dangerous and counterproductive. When Italian government proposed civil unions for same-sex couples, Catholic bishops warned lawmakers they had a moral duty to clearly and publicly voice their disagreement and vote against any proposed law that would recognise homosexual couples. You see, it's all there in one statement, isn't it? The Pope has a belief, good luck to him, can believe anything he likes. And so can people in the church believe anything they like. We need to pull up the drawbridge, however, when that belief floats over into the making of secular law. It is a belief, right? It is not necessarily absolute truth. It is a belief. And the floating of that belief, and we've seen it very recently in Australia, haven't we, in a debate, I think, in New South Wales recently, very recently, where that belief floats over. In the Philippines, a very similar debate has gone on. To balance the books, in Iran, the same thing occurs, where the President Mohammad Ahmadinejad of Iran talks about the teachings of Islam, and under Iran's criminal law, the actions and conduct of people engaging in homosexual behaviour is prohibited, and the law goes on for quite some time talking about the different punishments. And again, that is within the same report from the from Human Rights Watch. And the policing of that law has meant, as Human Rights Watch has said, that lesbian, gay, bisexual and transgender Iranians, both inside and outside Iran, but primarily inside Iran, are subject to arbitrary detention. They're persecuted, they're jailed, so too are their supporters. I'm pretty confident that I could extend this connection between secular law, religion and the denial of equality for persons across a number of the major religions. I don't think there would be any doubt about that. Not all, but certainly across a number. So what does this mean? Well, I think we live in a secular state. I don't think we live in a religious state. I don't deny that people have a right to religious belief, Nor do I deny the right of persons with particular religious beliefs to engage in the political process. But I certainly don't expect those people who are elected to allow their particular religious beliefs to influence their obligations as lawmakers in a secular state. And that's one of the issues that we really need to be honing in on. It's a difficult issue. I'm not pretending for a moment that it's a simple issue. But the secular state is one that I said is one of diversity and difference. The secular state is one that makes laws for the good of all, based not on religious beliefs, but on principles of law. It's not as if when you throw religious beliefs out, you've left with nothing, not at all. You're actually left with a huge body of international law which has embedded in it wonderful principles about equality, non-discrimination, dignity, well-being of human beings. It's not as if throwing out religious influences leaves us naked in the religious and moral and ethical domain, not at all. I also have to say that sometimes it's very difficult to argue scientifically, intelligently, with people who have particular religious beliefs. If someone has a particular religious belief and says to you that they spend most of their day blogging directly with God, it's just impossible to be able to argue. You just can't do it. There's a particular brand of debate going on at the moment where arguments about how long people have been on the planet simply can't proceed forward because one mob are saying they're getting direct emails from somebody from outer space. And then on the basis of that, I'm not trying to be funny here, I'm just trying to say, how can you have an intelligent discussion with that as the basis for it?
I think you dinged me, did you?
No,
I thought it was a ding. Shelley warned me that yesterday there was a ruthless dinger in the room. I've been sitting up here rather worried that I was going to get dinged very quickly. So I guess that is one of the things that I think is quite central to the affirmation of equality and dignity and all of those sorts of things, is a really proper debate about church-state. We've certainly had those debates in the past. I wouldn't say for a moment that this is something new. But we should not be just surrendering the advances that have been made about the construction of a secular state because we are living in a climate, in a time where there's been a rise of this religious fundamentalism. I don't care whether it's left, right, centre, religious fundamentalism. We shouldn't be surrendering that gain that's been made about the necessity. What the state is there not for a particular segment of the population. It is there for everybody in the population. And if Australia as a state, for example, signs up to international treaties which say that all persons are equal, irrespective of characteristic, then you would not expect that to be pulled up at the border because we've hit areas such as the ones we're interested in today. It would be unthinkable for Australia as a state to suddenly start to say, well, certain persons of colour are not allowed to enjoy the full range of human rights. I think it's just about as simple as that. In international law, we have very clear statements about what the rights of persons are in terms of their sexual orientation and their gender identity. Why is it that we pull up? One of the reasons is because we are influenced over and over again by particular religious institutions with particular religious values, and I think we let them have far too much influence on the lawmaking process. The last thing that I would say is that, of course, if you take this at a global level, the struggle is well and truly still on, and I think you'd agree with that. There are many countries around the world where this struggle for equality is far from over. In fact, in many instances, you could say it's running backwards, and in some instances, you would say it is only just beginning. Of course, in terms of Australian domestic law, in the last few years, and even in the last couple of weeks, we've seen some positive advances. The South Australian government's new laws, which you would all know about, has at least gone some way to bringing South Australia in line. The Victorian Law Reform Commission, as you probably know, has just this week brought down a set of recommendations which could see gay couples and lesbians residing in Victoria gain further legal rights, and it would include, if adopted in law, the right of same-sex couples to adopt children and to allow fertile lesbians access to IVF programs. As you know also, the Human Rights and Equal Opportunity Commission, I think you've had somebody speak on that, is to produce its report later this month, or release its report later this month, and it will talk about federal law and same-sex couples, workplace entitlements, social security tax, superannuation, and a whole range of others in the primarily in the sort of legal workplace domain. And I also understand that you've had the Labor Party here talking about the changes that has been made to its platform, but I understand that that platform specifically still says no to gay marriages. It's gone a bit further down the track, but no to gay marriages. I don't think I could be consistent by saying I agree with that. I certainly don't. On the basis of what I've already said, that in law, at the international level, there should be no discrimination in domestic law if you take the international law seriously. I guess in conclusion, I've been involved in the human rights movement, or whatever terminology you would like to use, for a very long time. And in that time, reading a bit about it as well, I guess the constant theme has been discrimination based on a human characteristic. Sometimes that human characteristic is race, it's ethnicity, it's colour, it's sexuality, it's sexual orientation. Sometimes it's political belief. If you wanted to sort of wrap a definition of human rights up in one or two quick sentences, it really is all about power and the minority. That's primarily what it's about. Every time you say human rights, we ought to be talking power, because the flip side of human rights is the exercise of power. Power can be exercised by government, but it can also be exercised by a range of other institutions. I guess what I'm saying here is power is being exercised by institutionalised religion, and we need to have a debate about whether or not, in a secular state, that remains appropriate, particularly in the context where international law is absolutely unequivocal about what these rights are. So we've seen this debate, this struggle, go on now for who knows how long. We've seen it in the civil rights struggles in the United States. We've seen it in the struggles in South Africa and elsewhere around the world. And I guess in the context of your deliberations this weekend, all we're saying really is that this is just another instance where the human rights struggle will proceed to get genuine equality, and equality is beautifully married with dignity and well-being. We would all agree with that. It's easy to say equality, but equality, the ability and capacity of persons just to enjoy their human life, that's all it is, isn't it? Sometimes you can make these things incredibly complex, but basically it's just to enjoy your life without those who have power interfering. I've said again, I think we ought to think in terms of human rights being the counterside to power. And that power can be exercised by the government, it can be exercised by the community, it can be exercised by institutions in our society. And against that power and the misuse and abuse of that power, because in this instance that's what I think is happening, are people like yourselves, the human rights defenders. And that human rights defence, I think, is something that enriches our lives, enriches our society, to have persons around who are determined in that struggle for equality. There can be no doubt that on the sides of the human rights defenders, there is a huge body of international law which has absolutely no equivocation about dignity, equality, non-discrimination. And we need to keep asserting that, and we need to keep building our arguments about furthering equality in this area, based not on belief, not on religion, but on the corpus of where international law is at present. And I think that your role in this, and the wider community's role in this, you know, it would just be wonderful if one day we could actually sit down in a society and say, we do not discriminate on any grounds here, because we value the richness of all human beings, irrespective of their characteristics.